Thank you, James. And with that, I would propose that we redouble our efforts to try to save sufficient time for comment from the audience. Let me now introduce Dr. Harvey Sickerman, who is president of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Dr. Sickerman holds a PhD in international relations from the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of numerous works on U.S. foreign policy, and in earlier years has served as special assistant to Secretary of State Alexander Haig. He has also served on the policy planning staff of Secretary of State James A. Baker, and also as consultant to Secretary of State George Shultz. Dr. Sickerman's presentation is entitled Contrary to the Program, Judaism and International Relations. Dr. Sickerman.
An admirable beginning. That will shorten my speech by half. I will have only. We don't need this. Okay. I want to thank you very much for that introduction and also to thank the Society for having me here today. Your meeting was admirably timed as it occurs in between the lectures of Professor Ralph Natali to a grand jury in Camden last week on the workings of the mafia, and a speech to be delivered by former President Clinton tonight in the suburbs of Philadelphia, the subject of which we know not. But I do congratulate you that at least in the middle between these two, we will have something sensible and perhaps a little bit more edifying than their testimonies. I have a very broad subject here. And because it concerns Judaism and international relations, I'm going to focus in particular upon what the Bible says on international relations and how that might be applicable to what we see today, and particularly in American foreign policy. I recognize that in doing so, and particularly in the short time available, that I'm going to cover an enormous amount of ground, and yet there will be an enormous amount of ground that I cannot cover, either because there is no time or because I simply don't know enough about it. And I would ask you to treat my speech in the spirit of the story that was told of a professor at Harvard Divinity School who used to give a course in Old Testament. And every year at the end of that course, he gave an examination and there was one question on it. Give me a list of the kings of Judah and Israel. Well, as you might expect, this course became very popular and finally reached such a level of scandal that the professor's colleagues prevailed upon him that he should at least change the question, which he did. And that year the question was, tell about the evolution of monotheism in ancient Israel. Well, one of the students caught in this change of questions wrote in answer to this that as a student new to the subject of Old Testament studies, he couldn't possibly say anything intelligent about so subtle a subject as monotheism in ancient Israel, but he was equipped to give a list of the kings of Judah and Israel, which he thought was more appropriate to his level of understanding. So if some of you get the feeling that this morning I'm giving you in parts a list of the kings of Judah and Israel, that's not because there isn't more to the subject, that's simply because that's what I happen to know. I will do this in two parts. The first part, I will go down a list of things, of what the Bible has to say about international relations, and because the subject is Judaism, I'm restricting this to the Hebrew Bible. The New Testament has a number of interesting things to say, particularly about the inner workings of the Roman Empire, but for very good reasons is not really concerned with international relations as a topic and covers a relatively brief span of time in any event. And so I will be restricted to this enormous corpus of the Bible. That will be in the first part, and then in the second part I will attempt to reach some conclusions that might be of use to us today from a description of this. Obviously, in the question period, you'll be free to ask whatever you'd like to ask, including how much this influences the modern-day state of Israel or the diplomatic situation in the Middle East. Let me start with what the Bible has to say about international relations. As many of you know, the Bible's business is really not international relations. It has to do with the covenant between God and Israel and the working out, or the way that didn't exactly work out in the expectations of the parties to this covenant. But in the course of doing so, the Bible does say a lot of interesting things about international politics. And among these, you could say the following. The first has to do with geography. In the Bible, the people of Israel are promised a specific space, the land of Israel, and if they fulfill their side of the bargain, they are promised that they will flourish in the land of Israel, and they certainly needed it. Israel in ancient times was located at the juncture point between competing empires in Egypt and those further north, whether Assyria or Babylonia. It was a very rich country, and it was very rich in oil, not petroleum, but date oil, and also olive oil. Date oil was the sugar of ancient times, and olive oil was the source of light and heat in ancient times. So you might say that this was a country that, like some of its neighbors today, had a very important economic function, and yet it was not easily defended, and the people of Israel were small compared to their neighbors. Well, this geography is to be found in a number of maps that you can locate in different parts of the Bible, and the funny thing about these maps is that they're not all the same. Some of them are very expansive, some of them are quite narrow. Some of them are divided by religious borders, others by political, still others by legal, and finally, still others by military considerations. And so if you attempt to locate the land of Israel in the Bible, you have to ask yourself, for what purpose? Because the borders are very different. Now, inevitably, a very practical consideration in establishing a border comes from the necessity of collecting taxes. And the tax system in the Bible is a very elaborate one, particularly the tax system that had to do with collections for the support of the temple, the tithes, and other such things. Well, what part of the land of Israel was obligated, were people obligated, where they were living, to deliver the tithes for the temple? There was a long Talmudic discussion on this, and there again, the borders are very different than from what you might expect. The conclusion of the rabbinical tradition was that the borders conquered by Joshua, because they were conquered by force and taken away by force, were not the sacred borders, but rather those established by Ezra when he returned with the people from the first exile, the Babylonian exile, because these were granted by consent and therefore cannot be taken away. But that set of borders is much smaller than even the borders of pre-1967 Israel. It's located in a different place than those pre-1967 borders, but fundamentally cover only the period ruled, the area that was given over to Ezra by the Babylonian king, by Cyrus the Great. And as a consequence, those areas, those are the sacred areas. This could split a community in two. There are cases to be found in the Talmud of where a town was separated in two. For the, once, if you were unlucky enough to live on one side, you had to pay the taxes, and on the other side, you didn't. So what the Bible has to say, importantly, about geography is that the concept of borders is a malleable one, not fixed for eternity, except in a fairly narrow sense, but that you could make adjustments in these borders depending on the circumstances and depending on the need. A second topic that is treated very much in the Bible is peace. This is considered to be a value of the highest order. And when we read in Numbers 6 from verses 22 to 27, the blessing of the high priest, it ends with the desire to that God should grant his people peace. And this echoes throughout the Bible, comes down in the Jewish liturgy to the present day. Most of you are probably familiar with the so-called Kaddish, which is the prayer that is recited to memorialize the dead. It, in fact, has no reference to the dead whatsoever in it, but does finish with a request of God that he who makes peace in his high places should also make peace upon the people of Israel and everybody else. And that's the final verse of it. So this emphasis on peace as an important value is very prominent throughout the Bible. And it is also associated very much with what today we would call international law. There are all sorts of treaties and covenants in the Bible. And these treaties and covenants, especially those accompanied by oaths, are considered to be highly significant. An oath was the most solemn thing that you could do. And anyone who violated an oath was considered ipso facto to be beyond the pale. Even in cases where one side, as we found in the case of the Gibeonites, who took an oath to Joshua, and later on it turned out that that oath was taken under false circumstances, Joshua insists nonetheless that the oath be kept on the part of the Israelites. And later on, when one of the tribes decides to attack the Gibeonites anyway, King David sends compensation to them for violation of this oath. So these treaties and the oaths that accompanied them are also considered of extreme significance, not to be cast off lightly, and certainly not to be undertaken for circumstances that when they change, that is just for expediency, to be tossed away as meaningless pieces of paper or as not so solemn undertakings at a later time. There are a lot of wars in the Bible. And these are primarily, the Bible sanctions two types. One is the obligatory, and that was the war of the Israelites to drive out the nations who dwelt in Canaan, there is no sense of an obligatory war anymore except one in self-defense because the Canaanite nations no longer exist. The evidence given in the Bible itself was that they were not exterminated. This was because they were given the choice of either of making peace with the incoming Israelites, or if they failed to make peace, at least agreeing not to worship idols anymore. The evidence from the Bible itself is, as I said, that these nations did not disappear, and there were large numbers. Joshua, at the end of his life, after 30 years of constant warfare and a few rather substantial miracles to his credit, nonetheless, 30% of the country was still not occupied by the Israelites, including the city of Jerusalem. So the evidence there is that the obligatory war, with one exception, is more or less moot and no longer applicable. As far as the other war is concerned, the so-called voluntary war, there are very elaborate rules concerning the waging of such a war. For example, one has to begin by offering peace. Another example, you're not permitted to uproot fruit-bearing trees in the course of a siege, an environmental measure of sorts. And when you get to the idea of who should serve in the army of the Israelites according to the Bible, well, this is a draft dodger's paradise, because we have preserved in Deuteronomy the speech that the priest has to give to the army on its way out. And basically, if you had just gotten married, or if you'd established a new house, or if you were simply afraid in a way that might sow panic, you were exempt. Given this, I suggest that the numbers that one sometimes finds in the Bible, as one encounters these days in the Middle East, that these numbers should be taken very carefully. Middle Easterners have trouble with zeros. And given the number of exemptions here, the size of the armies that were sometimes put forward should perhaps be discounted. These may have been the original lists of recruits, but it's highly doubtful, given this number of exemptions, that they could have amounted to those numbers. So there again you see an elaborate list of qualifications for who should serve and who should not serve. And we have one notable instance in the Bible in the case of Gideon, where he established yet an additional criteria. Before he allowed recruits into his army, he asked them to kneel to drink out of a pool of water. And if they knelt in a certain way, he disqualified them, evidently because their method of genuflection indicated that they were accustomed to worshiping idols, and he did not want any in his army who were not idol worshippers. So there you have it, who were idol worshippers. So there you have an additional criteria. There is in the Bible a very close connection between domestic and international affairs. The texts resound with denunciations of the people of Israel by prophets and others that if they fail to abide by the divine law, there will be consequences. And as the divine law concerns mostly domestic affairs, a lot of the consequences that are listed are actually come from abroad. And so the decline of the morality domestically has as its punishment and as its consequence the loss of influence, the loss of power, the loss of sovereignty, the loss of territory, ultimately the loss of the temple itself and the right of residence on the land. And this is a close connection made between domestic and international affairs. Finally, there is one important executive found in the Bible with respect to international relations, and that is the king. There is a long debate about whether the king was a desirable or less than desirable feature of the ancient polity. But suffice to say that the Bible makes rather elaborate rules there too in case a king should be picked. He had to be male, he had to be Jewish, he had to be of a certain age, and he actually emerges as a very limited figure. For example, the Bible has strictures that he should not be able to accumulate wealth or wives. This was an important matter, wealth as measured particularly in horses. Because the ancient kings prided themselves on their ability to put in the field the armor and the tanks of the day, horses and chariots on the one hand, and on the other hand, the taking of wives was an important part of statecraft, as we know even until quite recently and even today in various parts of the world where a ruler would take on a wife as part of an alliance, a relationship. Well, it doesn't say in the Bible how many wives are too many, but the rabbis, by an ingenious exegesis from another verse that states, "You shall live by them and not die by them," a verse that refers to the laws as a whole, the Hebrew word for life, chai, when you add up the numerical value of the two letters, it comes to 18. Therefore, the rabbis concluded that a king should live with no more than 18. Evidently, King Solomon had not heard of this particular. He had some thousand, and these were judged against him as being in excess for which he suffered, and as it turned out, everybody suffered. So these are just some of the rules and regulations that you find in the Bible, and they indicate pretty clearly that the Bible has a very realistic view of human affairs and of international relations in particular. We would recognize all parts of this in our current times. Even the two episodes of spies that we find in the Bible, the one in just before the mission that miscarried, because you had too many of the spies, they were heads of the tribes, belonged to the chattering classes, and spent too much time talking about what they were doing. That was the unsuccessful mission. And then the very successful mission, Joshua's two spies, whose names are not known to history, truly the secret service, and they were very successful. We would recognize all of these things today as part of the typical run of international relations. But side by side with this exposition of realism, there's another part of the Bible that doesn't belong to that category at all. And this has to do with the prophets. Now, I mentioned that the king has an important but limited role. The king, every king, was known as a Messiah, because Messiah in Hebrew simply means anointing. He was the anointed one, and he was anointed with olive oil in a special ceremony. But the prophets took this expression of the anointed one and attributed to it and prophesied that at the end of days and in the fullness of time, there would be eventually a redemption of the people of Israel and a messianic era that would be brought about by a messianic figure. He would be preceded by the prophet Elijah. Even then, they knew that you needed an advanced man for anybody to get anywhere. And this figure would lead to a complete transformation, not only of human society, but of international society. And that's what you get, as you find in Ezekiel and other places. The wolf lies down with the lamb, whether in actuality or whether it's metaphorical. The large nations lie down with the small nations. However you wish to interpret it, the fact of the matter is that the prophets foresee a radically changed international situation, a veritable transformation of human behavior itself when the Messianic era comes on. So you have side by side, existing in the Bible, the very realistic approach with its rules and regulations, and the expectation that at some point there will be a complete transformation and an elimination of all these rules and limitations, because there will be a change in human behavior, so that the world is not necessarily as we find it. It need not be the way it is. It can be something radically different. Let me come now to my second part and my concluding part that has to do with what lessons we might be able to draw from this exposition of the Bible. And I look at four, and they are a range between the sacred and the profane, between the ideal as it might be and the real as it is. Now, the first has to do with the geographical and the placement. Ideally, in the Bible, what you have is the people of Israel living in the land of Israel, worshiping God according to the way that he's laid down the rules. That is the ideal. The Bible itself tells us that that ideal was rarely achieved. And as a consequence, there is the real. And the real is that there is a certain geography and place and tradition that belongs to the Jews. Now, for our purposes, if we wanted to make that universal, we would say that the lesson is that if you're dealing in this world, you come from a place and a tradition, and that's the only way that you can have any particular effect on the rest of the world. That the idea that you belong to a universal civilization, or that you levitate independently of a time and place and with no particular tradition to call your own, this is an entirely foreign experience to the Bible, and it suggests, of course, that it's entirely foreign to human behavior, that people don't work that way. Everybody comes from some place. Everybody has some kind of identity and tradition, and it is the cherishing of these places and identity and tradition that can make a difference. A second has to do with the ideal that in the Messianic period there would be an end to the wars and divisions that have marked so much of human history. That's the ideal. The real is that if you have to get involved in this dirty business, there are rules and limits, and that the optional war, or the so-called war of state, is not simply a war that is undertaken to exterminate others or for frivolous reasons, or that does not have restrictions in the way it's conducted and the way that it's ended. And I think that that has a great deal of applicability, particularly as we saw in the last, meaning the 20th century, when wars were waged without reference to rules or limits whatsoever. The third has to do with the relationship between domestic and international affairs. As we've seen in the ideal, all will be well with the Jewish people if they obey the laws that have been given to them. The real, that this is not always the case. But what it does illustrate for us, that virtue has its rewards and vice also has its rewards. And that a people who are weak and divided and immoral at home inevitably get themselves into a great deal of trouble abroad. And that, I think, is also an important lesson on the relationship between domestic and international affairs. And finally, and most significantly, in the ideal, there is an allegiance beyond the state. The king, for example, has to carry around with him a Torah, a code of law, and at least once a year is required to recite this code, especially those portions having to do with his limitations, in public. And this reminds the king that no matter how eminent he may be in his own eyes or in the eyes of his subjects, he is constrained by a higher law. That is the ideal. The real is that the states don't often behave that way. We've seen in our own century where the state itself has been worshipped as the highest ideal. And Judaism, as found in the Bible, reminds us that there is something higher than that. And on this I would like to close, that it also reminds us that the individual acting as the individual or governments acting on behalf of their nations have a larger consequence that may go beyond the material circumstances of their actions, a spiritual dimension perhaps. And that it would be well with our statesmen if before they acted they considered that the consequences of their actions may not simply be on the mere calculation of their material interests, but also had a spiritual consequence for their societies as well. Thank you.